I'm Bob Boylan with All Songs Considered. Folk music's a funny term these days. We refer to folk music as almost anything a singer-songwriter does with an acoustic instrument. When I worked in record stores in the 1970s, Simon and Garfunkel were in the folk section. Dylan was in the folk section. Joan Baez, James Taylor. But the music that inspired those folk musicians were Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, the Carter Family, Elizabeth Cotton, Roscoe Holcomb, Alice Gerard, and Hazel Dickens. This is the world that Anna and Elizabeth inhabit. It's a world of story songs from long ago sung by, well, folks, not big-time entertainers.
This is Anna.
Okay, now.
This is Anna, yep.
Elizabeth.
This is Elizabeth.
Oh, God, do that again.
This is Anna.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Elizabeth.
That's Anna and Elizabeth. For their new album, their second album, The Invisible Comes to Us, the duo went to an archive in Middlebury College in Vermont to uncover old songs, dig into their history, and find new ways to express them. Anna and Elizabeth are in New York City. I'm here in Washington, D.C. So today, a conversation with Anna and Elizabeth, and I start by playing a song called The Ripest of Apples. It's from their new album on Folkways. It's a song they discovered in that Vermont archives.
Come, my friends and dear companions, come and mourn a while with me, for I have lost my own dearest jewel, clothing, mourning I must be. When I'm asleep, I'm dreaming about him. When I'm awake, I take no rest. Must I cross this wild, cruel ocean to see the one that I love?
Anna and Elizabeth, welcome. And
thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
And I, when I listen to the song and think about what you do, there is this stereotypical notion that, like, old folk songs always come from the South, right? I mean, they're
right.
Always to come from the mountains or the rural areas of the South.
Yeah.
Tell me about Ripest of Apples.
Well, this song was recorded in the 1940s originally in northern New Hampshire, in the home of
way
this
down there.
Way, yeah. It was recorded by this woman, Helen Flanders, who was this woman who was, I guess, like us, very obsessive about old songs and made 4,000 recordings in New England.
What?
And Wait, they're all at an archive in Middlebury College. Yeah, she just went through New England and talked to old people during the 1940s, so it meant they were people born in the 1860s, some of them, and they were singing songs from their childhoods. So that song came from this woman, Belle Luther Richards, of Colebrook, New Hampshire. Yeah, it's a really beautiful song about a very old topic, which is heartbreak.
Our joke is that, sometimes it's very hard to relate to these old songs, and you might have to really use your imagination to relate to this theme.
Yeah.
Because it used to happen a lot, especially.
Yeah, it doesn't anymore.
In the old days, that was a real thing.
Yeah, especially down south, right?
Exactly. Yeah,
right.
So
yeah.
Where is that notion come from? And
oh, man.
Yeah.
Well, I'm Anna, and mm-hmm. I grew up in New England. My family's from there, and like many New Englanders, got really into Southern and American folk music. And so I moved to rural Kentucky and then to rural Virginia, which is where I met Elizabeth, where she's from. And so the first like 6 years, 5 years of our band, we did traditional Appalachian music. And then I think this was this record was inspired by just an increasing desire to be like, oh, well, I think there's folk music from where I'm from, and wanting to, I guess, just really do my homework. Because it is true that you kind of grow up associating the South with mm-hmm. American folk music, especially, you know, the ballad tradition. But it's not true.
So you dug through what archives where and found?
Yeah, so it was about 2 years ago, and we spent a couple months. I was in Vermont listening at this archive in Middlebury College, where they have a collection of traditional folk music collected. It's the Helen Harkness Flanders Ballad Collection.
Oh.
And yeah, it's just a room in the basement of the library where you can listen to these 4,000 recordings.
So what are you listening on, and what are you looking at? Are you looking through a card catalog? Or are you holding on to tape? What are
you
doing?
They give you a laptop, and you're just sitting there at a desk a laptop.
Could you make something up?
It's not very romantic. Yeah, for that reason, both of us also get really into trying to go to the places where the recordings were made, because it can be kind of boring to just be in a library because you know the recordings were made in these people's houses. So this Ripest of Apples song, I went to Colebrook and I interviewed the grandson and the great-granddaughter of the original singer. The great-granddaughter's name is Linda, and she had no idea that her great-grandmother had been recorded, so I gave her the recordings.
Wow.
And since then, she's like been learning all of her family songs, and we've gotten to sing with her, and that's been really amazing. And she took me to the house where the recording was made, which is abandoned, and I spent a nice quiet hour there, like playing the old recordings back into the room. And I don't know, I think folk music is so connected to place and different people's families. So there's this sense of wanting to just have these very sensory and landscape-based experiences with the old songs before you sing them yourselves. At least I think that's part of our me and Elizabeth's process.
Yeah, this is Elizabeth talking. After spending a long time on Appalachian songs, which is where I'm from, and is, you know, I'm obviously very excited about Appalachian visibility, but I think that something we always shared was this idea that anybody could do research into the place where they're from and find music. And so the bulk of the songs on the new album are these songs from Anna's research up in New England. There are a couple of Virginia ones from research that I did too. But it's fun to just throw a little visibility on folk songs from other places than the kind of typical narrative that you see of Southern songs.
Is that where the record title comes from, The Invisible Comes to Us?
It comes from an essay that our friend wrote, and I guess just this idea that there is kind of history everywhere, like that it is this invisible thing that is around you, and if you pay attention to it, it was like this experience of starting to pay attention to the history of where I grew up. Like, one of the songs is from a singer who was from like 20 minutes away from where I grew up. And yeah, from kind of that idea of like, oh, there's this history of every single place, and trying to tap into that.
I'm wondering if you can characterize, if it's fair to even begin to characterize the differences when you start to listen to the more northern music.
Yeah.
There's a couple general things. For one, there's a lot of mention of the ocean and sailing and sailors in New England music, a little bit more
Our record has a lot more ocean songs.
Than mountain
songs, even though, just the history is a little bit different. And I think definitely in Southern music, you hear more of the influence of African-American music in Appalachian singers of all races. I feel like that kind of mingling happened in the South in ways that it didn't really happen in the North.
Can I put you on the spot and ask you, like, is there anything in the inflection that you could sort of sing to someone to...
Almost. I felt like some of the singers felt even more unchanged. Like, there are these singers from Maine who sounded... You're like, this guy sounds Irish still. Like, his voice didn't... Whereas I feel like sometimes when I listen to Appalachian singers, I think really like, well, this is an Appalachian singer. Like, I don't... I can recognize the difference between an Irish traditional singer and someone who's from North Carolina.
Yeah.
The old singers. Where I feel like some of the singer... this one town in Maine, there were like four singers collected from that town, and they all just had... Their ornamentation was very Irish still. So it didn't really mix with anything maybe as much.
And even in terms of the accent, just the way the voice sounds and the pronunciation, like the melodies too, but even just in the way the words sound, you can hear that, that person really just sounds very Irish.
Well, it's also like, it's kind of banjo-free music. Like, I think that was
And the
big...
timing is different because of that.
Because also I think with a lot of the Southern music, there's so many examples of how to arrange Southern music, because that's been happening since the Carter family, mm-hmm. where, you know, how do you add an instrument to this unaccompanied ballad? And so I feel like this, for this record, that's what I think started us going in different musical directions, because it was like, oh, I can't totally tell how to arrange this song immediately.
You can't just add a banjo to it
yeah.
in the same way.
So we just started realizing, that's, I think, what triggered the realization we could integrate all the other sounds that we liked to hear with these songs.
How about if I do this? I'm going to play Ripest of Apples again.
Yeah.
But this time I'm going to keep your mics open and I'm going to duck down. Why don't you tell me what's going on, like where you are when the foot's tapping, or what's the instrument that comes in, or what's that bassy thing at the bottom.
Cool. All right.
Let's give this a shot. Here you go.
Cool. Okay. That's me on guitar, Anna, and that's Jim White playing drums.
From the Dirty Three.
Ah! Who is so fun to work with. And he loves folk music.
Yeah.
And, I first heard him when he played with Siloris White. And we kind of had the idea of him trying to play the melody sometimes instead of just laying down a groove, which is kind of how this strange, beautiful drum part happened. I'm talking a little bit over too, which I love Laurie Anderson. So anytime, I'm starting to see how many tracks I can just talk instead of sing.
Yeah. Well, this is one of the last pieces that we put in was the talking. I think we were like, there's something missing from the choruses.
It's like, just talk.
It's whispering.
Let's hear.
His eyes are clear as a crystal fountain. And Ben Davis, our co-producer, is adding kind of the ambient sounds. I think he was playing, who knows what he's playing? Maybe Mellotron.
So there definitely it was electronics. I didn't see that coming, but it just lays under there, this nice bottom end.
Yeah.
I think it's the big bassy end is coming here.
Yeah. This is a classic Benjamin Lazar Davis line. It's funny when we're arranging all this music, we are so used to playing traditional music, which is kind of doesn't really put an emphasis on form. You just really just kind of are used to jamming and you're like, cool, this, like Elizabeth and I didn't really have a huge language of how to rehearse the music we played. You just kind of like, here's the song, and then you play it. So
right, start the song and then you end it almost.
Yeah.
It's the arrangement.
So this whole record was this deep, steep learning curve of this idea of like, oh, making arrangements and adding instruments here. And it was the first time we really did a record in a studio. Like all the arrangements really came over many weeks layered in studios and thinking about thinking of it more as a collage for the first time, which was terrifying and really exciting at the same time.
Yeah, we learned so much in that process.
Let's listen to the last minute in the clear here. That's really beautiful.
Thanks. That last line always makes me smile.
Yeah. And a little tap of the drum is beautiful.
Yeah.
You said something earlier that I want to zero in on, which is that you went back to the house and met the great-granddaughter, was it?
Yeah, Linda.
So can you walk us through that a little more? So you're in a library. You're sitting with a laptop romantically listening to old folk tunes. And then you find one. You find Ripest of Apples.
Yeah, and it's, you know, and I think that song, it was the lyrics. I was like, oh, whoa, I love these lyrics, and the last verse is amazing, and I really want to sing this one. And Yeah, and then I just started Googling the last name of this woman and did some Ancestry.com like research and started cold calling people with the name of Richards.
All right, so tell me about some of those.
Yeah, so I just started calling people saying, hi, like, I'm a folk singer, and did your grandmother by any chance sing any ballads? And then finally I got a hold of Linda. It was just a random, you know, it was like some newspaper article that was online that mentioned, you know, some roundabout way. My dad was a journalist, and I feel like that kind of like thing is like very fun for me to try to track these people down. And
so you called her first, or
yeah,
or,
I just,
okay, so tell
I
me
called
that.
Her.
Walk me through that.
I don't so totally remember that, but I just was like, you know, are you related to Bell Luther Richards? She was like, yes, and I was like, well, she sang, and she's like, oh, I was like, I very stumbled through, you know, like, I'm like, play folk music. Because when you're not, like, an academic, you can't be like, I'm calling from such and such university to them. Right. You know, you're just like, I'm a random person. I love folk music and I sing. And can I come up and interview you about your ancestor? And she said, sure. And so I, like, drove up. It had snowed and I drove a half an hour through an unplowed road the wrong way. I got really lost and finally made it to their house, just this yellow farmhouse, and interviewed Linda and her father. So Belle was his grandmother. It's kind of funny, like, I feel like memories of an old man about his grandmother are always very kind of, they're just these beautiful little anecdotes, like, oh, I think I remember she had flowers, she loved a garden. And they're usually so fond, and we listen to the recordings, and it's funny, Linda's father died about 3 months after I interviewed him, and she said, she was like, I saw her later, and she was like, you know, it's so cool because it was like you were having him hear this voice that he was about to hear in heaven. She's very religious, and I feel like that's such a deep part of what you can do as a folk singer, because there are these songs, but it's also like these little family heirlooms of this family that you're not really connected to, but you can kind of help people think about their families.
What a gift.
Yeah, yeah, it was amazing. So we hung out and did this little interview and chatted, and then she had a choir rehearsal for the Christmas choir show, so she had to dash, but on the way...
So she's a singer.
She's a singer, and now she's singing her great-grandmother's songs, which is so cool.
What a beautiful story.
Yeah. So I, like, followed her out, and we passed the house where her great-grandmother lived, and she was like, I have to go on, but, you know, this is the house, and the house is abandoned, and I just stayed there, and then I, like, went in the house because it was unlocked, and there's no one there. I guess it's a sort of pilgrimage that I like to take with these songs, where because they're not your family's songs, but you know that you're going to, like, take them around the world with you, it's this way of trying to understand on, like, a physical level, I think, of, like, oh, this song came from this place, and trying to imagine this grandmother who was sitting in this room that you're in, and her singing this song that she had carried around for, you know, 80 years. It's like folk music's pretty humbling when you think about it that way, which is, I think, good for any human to try to get a little humbled.
So when someone like Bell Luther Richards or any of the 3,999 other songs that you listen to or were recorded, these aren't people who had tape recorders in their house.
Right.
So tell me, how does someone like Bell, who probably was playing, you know, music for her family and outside or whatever, how did she, and typically how did many people get recorded and then wind up in a library?
Yeah,
on
that's a whole other kind of, I mean, it's romantic if you think research is romantic, but it's a kind of beautiful, there were all these people who got excited about collecting songs and for whatever reason, and some, you know, were poets or their interest was literature, or Helen Flanders.
She joined a ladies' like poetry society in central Vermont, and then they were like, we need someone to record ballads of Vermont, because, yeah, at the time they were romanticized as this, like, oh, the everyday people have this poetry and it's ballads. And so she, I think, initially had a one-year grant to do it, and then she never stopped. And so it was, I think she was recording onto, like, I think it was like a cylinder dictaphone machine that was very big but portable, and just went, she kind of like us, she just went
town to town,
and she'd say, do you know any singers? And she
her
would
diaries,
hear stories.
Her excitement is insane.
She's like,
she gets a new day of collecting. I can't believe I get to get in the car and drive to a new town and quest for another singer. I mean, I'm ad-libbing, but
yeah,
the
but
tone
was
is
like that.
Like that.
Yeah. Or she talked about being anxious. She would like walk through a crowd and she's like, oh, but you don't know, like maybe one of the people passing me is a folk singer. Like,
I think we relate to that excitement in some way.
Yeah.
Even though we don't travel as much in search of songs, we more kind of find the song and then go looking for descendants of the singer or kind of traces of them somewhere.
And the music's so awesome because it kind of twists a little bit the way that you might grow up understanding what music is and how you consume it, because, yeah, it was all these people who were... yeah, singing for their families, which is so different than what record's coming out this week. Or actually, every time I read on NPR the songs we're listening to this week, yeah, I was like, well, these are songs that were released this week that you're listening to. But there's this sense of like listening to field recordings. It's like this other kind of plane of like, oh, here's like all these people who are creating music for non-recording purpose. It was this weird, like, transitional time for music. That's kind of amazing that it was documented.
Yeah, it wasn't for the masses. It was for the...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was for, like, three people that were related to you.
Yeah.
Well, this is really wonderful. What I'm going to do is I'm going to play the song Without Us Talking.
Okay.
And the record's called The Invisible Comes to Us. It comes out on Folkways, which before we go,
yeah,
is kind of interesting because we all think of Folkways. You grew up on Folkways music, meaning that label, and
totally
changed your life, right?
Yeah,
it did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I'm excited too because I feel like when you go deep into the catalog, it is like a mixture of folk songs and then like really, really weird folk music that would never release. Like, there's this brass bands of the South of like the 30s. It's so strange that it moves into experimental music. Mm-hmm. And so then Folkways also releases all this amazing back catalogs of experimental music too. So for me, I'm like, oh, that's so cool.
Right. That's the Venn
it's
diagram.
The same record label as David Tudor.
Yeah. Of our interests of like where traditional music and where experimental music meet is a really fascinating, beautiful place that especially Anna has gotten really into exploring.
And they often both come from a place of, in some ways, isolation.
Totally.
And you're doing this because you have to do it. And you're doing this because you love to do it. And you're not doing it for anything connected with fame whatsoever.
Yeah,
and
it's
that's the beauty of it for me.
I feel like we're starting to think of folk music as like another underground scene, the way that, you know, when I go to like three people doing free improvisation in a basement in Brooklyn, I'm like, it's kind of just like folk music.
Exactly.
It's like that, you know, listening to Susan Alcorn, she's like, to me, she is like a deep folk musician in that idea of folk music being these individuals who play music for whoever is around them.
Yeah. And in the same way that people have rightly drawn, you know, connecting lines between folk music and DIY punk music, mm-hmm, or DIY rap music. It's that like, oh, yeah, as you say, I have to make this. I have to make something, and it's coming out kind of no matter what.
Yeah.
And you all have started, long ago, 5 years ago or so, you started a cranky festival in Baltimore. It's not a bunch of people who are not in a good mood, but this is about these beautiful unfolding scrolls that tell a story as music plays.
Well, I guess it's just that is a part of our work, I think, that, yeah, it's hard to talk about on the radio, but, yeah, just the idea of trying to get people draw people into the old songs.
No pun intended.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, right. And sometimes we use visual art.
Yeah, but I think this idea of, like, we love this old weird stuff, and when we've listened to it for 10 years plus, and so when we hear it, you start to imagine this very rich world in each of the songs, and so, but kind of know that our audiences are, like, I don't always listen to 6-minute ballads, or just trying to make it accessible and magical the way that we experience it. So sometimes it's through these illustrations. And I think this record was our attempt to just kind of say, oh, how can we use more sounds to try to really be a little bit more illustrative of the more emotional landscapes, I guess, that we hear in the songs.
Kind of translating our visual imaginations into a sound palette.
Yeah, a lot of our instructions in the studio were like, okay, this song needs like a forest scene, and this song is like the ocean, and so it's like unchanging horizon, but it's really
very deep. Yeah. Or can you take this sound and put it far away on a little cloud way off in the distance?
But yeah, embracing the visual. We're very visual thinkers, so trying to make music as visual thinkers is a fun challenge.
and one that I think all of our collaborators were very up to, which was a great experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love the adventure that I went on listening to this, so thank you for that. And everybody gets to hear it soon. Let's go out on the song we've been playing, but there's more to come. Be well. Thank you.
Thanks.
Anna and Elizabeth. Their new album, The Invisible Comes to Us, is out March 30th on Folkways. You can watch a video premiere of another new song by Anna and Elizabeth called Mother in the Graveyard. That's on the All Songs Considered site. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.
Don't be controlled.